From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
So where a gift comes from, and what obligations of reciprocity it brings with it, what we have to do and what we shouldn't do to preserve the spirit of the gift, these things are mysterious, and we struggle all the time to find a way to talk about them.
Welcome to Soundings, Gifts and Friendship. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are Lewis Hyde of Harvard University and Ronald Sharp of Kenyon College. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Lewis Hyde about his book, The Gift, Imagination and the Erotic Life of Property. Following that, a commentary by Ronald Sharp about friendship and gift exchange. In his book about the giving and receiving of gifts, Lewis Hyde draws upon the opposition of Eros and Logos. In this configuration, Eros represents connection, or drawing together, while Logos represents differentiation, or the spirit of logic. Here is Lewis Hyde.
Well, in a way, the book began with the question, if we're going to speak of works of art as a kind of property, how are they best described? And of course, you can tell from my title that the intuition behind the book is that they're not well described as commodities, that they are something else. And I began in a way with the sort of common experiences that we have with works of art. The first question is, why do we speak of artists as gifted people? Mm-hmm. Does that mean something? And of course, when you think about it, a gift in that sense, to have a gift, to be a gifted painter or a gifted musician, we have a sense that we're speaking of a person who has an ability that they didn't acquire entirely through an act of will. That is to say, a gifted musician is somebody who just can play the guitar better than you or I could, no matter how much we practiced. They have some antecedent endowment. So there's that sense of giftedness connected to art, just in the way we talk about it. A second thing that seems to me to put works of art and the life of the artist in this gift economy, as I call it, is many artists, when they speak about their own work, have a sense that the work itself comes to life when something unexpected happens. You're sitting and writing a poem, and if in some way you knew exactly what you were going to write ahead of time, then it wouldn't be a creative act. Or if you knew exactly what the painting would look like before you started, there's some boredom to that. That the part of the pleasure of art is to get into the work and then have something surprising happen mm-hmm. that you didn't expect. And so it's not only that we speak of talent as a gift, but even as you create the work, there's some sense of things coming to you that are slightly outside of your own ego.
So you're telling me, Lewis Hyde, that there's a triangle here. There is the gift itself, the ability, there is the artist, and then there is what is outside of the artist.
Yes, there's something that comes to the artist from outside, and whether you talk about it as coming out of your own imagination. Mm-hmm. Another way I think that artists talk about it is many artists have a sense of being in a tradition. By which I mean that you have other artists in the past
models.
Whose work informs your work.
Sure.
And that, in a way, is the third sense of gift that I'm trying to get at in this work. My own experience before I began writing this book was that there were certain artists who mattered to me, whose work I was grateful that they had lived and that they had labored in the service of their own ability and that they had left this work for the rest of us. Now that sense of gratitude, again, is a sign that somehow this life of art is well placed in a language of gift exchange. That if you feel gratitude for something, then apparently you've received a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And let me say then that the first thing that people usually say about gift exchange, what it is to give a gift, is that it makes a connection between two people. if I give you something, Wayne, and then a week later you give me something in return, and if this begins to go on and we start having each over for dinner and so forth, it's about relationship. It's about being connected one person to another person. And in that sense, gift exchange is an emanation of Eros. Mm-hmm. It's about erotic life, about community.
So you're not necessarily here, Lewis Hyde, talking about the sexual. You're not necessarily talking about the procreative Eros, again, in the sense of drawing things together.
Right.
All right.
And the opposition then, if you talk about logos as a separating function, mm-hmm. one of the things to follow the contrast, gifts make a connection between people. The other side is to say that market exchange leaves no necessary connection between two people.
So we have gifts on the one side of the equation, we have market exchange on the other.
There's a wonderful phrase in the ethnography about gift exchange. They talk about sharing without reckoning. Mm-hmm. So there's gift exchange all around us. However, I also think that it, in a way, is invisible. That we primarily think of exchange as market exchange. And in a way, the language of gift exchange it's there, but it's hidden. Even to talk about a gifted person, we sort of forget the true implication of that. So part of what I was trying to do in this book is not to invent a language about art, but to show an old language that has always been with us, and try to make it less invisible.
Mm-hmm. You've written, Lewis Hyde, that you're going to have to coach me with the right word here. The best gift, the true gift, the gift itself, is something that continues to circulate. In contrast to the notion of gift exchange as a commodity, why is that? That you have certain anthropological models in mind when you
well, this was one. This was one of the things that surprised me most when I began to read through the literature on giving and receiving gifts. One way I got started thinking about this was thinking about the phrase Indian giver.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in common speech now, that means somebody who gives you something, but it's an insincere gift. They don't really mean to give it to you. But I thought, that can't really be what that means.
Or they want it back.
Yeah, they want it back.
Yeah.
I thought this must be a mistranslation in some way.
Uh-huh.
So I tried to track that down, and it turns out that phrase is first used by the historians who were writing about the Puritans in New England several centuries ago. And they were trying to explain something about the way the Indians treated property. And it turns out, in tribal groups, when somebody gives you a gift, there's a sense that isn't really your thing. That the gift, you're like a custodian. The gift is yours for a time, but you're supposed to give it away again. So I give you some wonderful object, and you keep it for a while, but if you're true, if you understand the spirit of gift-giving, you will give that thing away again, or you will give away something else of equivalent value.
So we have taken a phrase that intrinsically has much merit to it, and we've turned it on its head.
Yes.
And made it into a pejorative
yeah.
kind of thing.
One of the converse thing about being in a tribal group or a small group that where there's a tremendous amount of gift exchange, uh-huh. is that you are trapped in it. That there are the old line about a gift having a string is true. It doesn't, again, the spirit of the thing is important. There can be sort of tighter and looser strings. But, or if you think about small town life, if you live in a small town where people are constantly exchanging favors, at the same time, you are caught up in that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we as Americans, we like our freedom. We like to be able to just forget about everybody else and go down the road or just move to a different town.
Natty Bumpo giving gifts.
Yeah. And if that's what you value, if you value that disconnectedness,
uh-huh.
then commodity exchange is something that you'll like.
Is this a good thing or a bad thing for our culture? Is it for you to say that?
I guess my position is more a question of the balance between the two.
I see.
I feel that neither of these things is good or bad of itself, but the problem is what kind of a mix you have and whether there is any understanding of the spirit of gift exchange,
mm-hmm.
and and honor, respect for it. And what the times that I get upset about market exchange in this country are when it seems to me to be obliterating this other form of exchange, mm-hmm. or even drawing its energy from this other form of exchange. I'll give you an example. It seems to me that a great deal of advertising on television tries to induce people, tries to lure people in as if there were gift exchanges going on, and use our longing for connection to other people, our longing for Eros, as a way of selling commodities.
But now that's spurious.
Well, it's not just spurious, but it, in a sense, it's an example of the marketplace drawing its energy mm-hmm. from this other sphere of relationship between people.
Lewis Hyde, we're talking about your book, The Gift, with the subtitle Imagination and the Erotic Life of Property. How do folk and fairy tales illuminate this conception or proposition that you were discussing? What is it that we learn from looking at our, what do you want to call it, our ethnic history, our collective ethnic history?
Well, maybe I should say first that the reason this question comes up is that in my book, one thing I did was to go and read all the fairy tales I could find that had gifts in them. Mm-hmm. And what I was hoping was to find some sort of collective wisdom about what a gift is, and then try to read it for other people. Say, well, here's a fairy tale. Let's see how we can read that fairy tale, that, some sort of old news. And I was trying to get away from sort of the sociological language of gift exchange into a more literary language. Maybe I'll give you one example of a fairy tale that we all know. There's an old story about the shoemaker and the elves. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of odd details in it that I'll remind people of. One is that the shoemaker is down on his luck, not making any money, and nobody will buy his shoes. And he cuts out a little couple of pieces of leather, and that night the elves show up and sew them into beautiful shoes. Now, the elves are naked. They have no clothes when they come. And they come night after night, and the shoemaker begins to be able to sell his shoes. And after a certain period of time, his wife says to him, you know, we should stay up one night and see who it is who's doing this wonderful work for us. So they stay up, and they see the naked elves come. And the wife says, we should make them some clothes. And so they do. She makes little clothes for them, and he makes little shoes for them. And they leave them out. And that night, the elves show up, and they say, wow, we can get dressed now. And they say, we don't have to be shoemakers anymore. And they put the clothes on and run away. And that's the end of the story.
What does this teach us?
Well, there are two things to see in this story. One is the problem of expressing gratitude. One is the problem of receiving a gift. Mm-hmm. You know, the funny thing in this story for me is how long it takes the shoemaker to express his gratitude. They first give him the gift, but he waits 6 or 8 months until it's sort of increased enough that he can make his own living, and then he says thank you. Now, it's as if a gift that's given to you isn't yours yet until you've changed in some way.
Or reciprocated by the expression of gratitude. Is that what you mean?
Yes. In this case, though, the implication is at the beginning of the tale that the shoemaker isn't really a shoemaker. He wants to be one, but he can't make shoes that will sell.
The elves have to do it for him.
It's like being a young artist. Mm-hmm. You go to the museum and you see these wonderful paintings, and somehow you know that you want to be a painter. And you go home and you make this horrible painting. You're not a painter yet.
Right.
So in some way, your talent is beginning to wake, but it's not yours yet. So there is a long period in which, I call it the labor of gratitude. There's a period in which you feel gratitude somehow, but you aren't able to actually return the gift. You can't make the painting that expresses the talent you have, or that expresses your gratitude for the masters who informed you. In the same way, this shoemaker can't make his shoes yet. It sort of grows slowly in him. And there comes a moment when he is finally able to make a pair of shoes and give them back to the shoemaker. I guess the thing I'm associating to is parents and children. Uh-huh. You know, you raise your children, in a sense, it's an entire gift-giving relationship. You pour all this stuff into them, and there's this dependency that always goes with gift exchange, that the person who is the recipient is dependent on the donor.
Right.
But that isn't, in the long term, that isn't necessarily the form of relationship you want. And
sure, every parent will tell you, I want my kid to be independent. I want him to.
Well, they do and they don't, you know. Yeah. that goes on your whole life. But that moment in which the person is finally empowered enough to be able to give gifts on their own,
uh-huh.
it means that person is somehow, at that point, freed of the obligation. And the donor is somehow freed, too. This idea, again, of tribal groups or small groups of people whose community adheres through faithfulness and gratitude and a constant gift exchange. A good way to destroy such a group, and this has happened many times in this century, is to go in and convert all of their gift relationships into cash relationships. Say, well, this is an old custom where you give this to that person on that. Let's just buy and sell.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is, in a funny way, logically, it looks like exactly the same relationship. That is, one thing, money is exchanged for another thing, just as one thing, a pig, used to be exchanged for another thing.
Mm-hmm.
However, the relationship part is missing, and the group begins to be destroyed. And yes, you can look at this country, and you can look at the art world, and say, well, does the spirit of the gift seem to be alive here? And part of the point of this book is not just to say that the language has become invisible, that there is gift exchange, but we don't notice it, but also to say that artists in this highly commercial society are constantly at risk of being kind of forgetting why they got into it to begin with and what really matters in their work, and being drawn into marketing themselves and becoming celebrities.
Lewis Hyde, we're talking about your book, The Gift. I think of a story by a North Carolinian, The Gift of the Magi, which is, what, early 20th century, something like that. Where do you look in our literary cultural models today for your notions of the gift? I'm asking you to talk about specific writers, specific poems, things that have moved you to write this book.
Well, I'll tell you one story that is a story about an artist, and that was an early inspiration to me. You know, all artists have sort of their own mythology of what made them an artist and how their art fits into the wider world. A poet who was important to me as a young writer was Pablo Neruda, a Chilean poet. And Neruda has an essay called Poetry in Childhood, in which he tries to explain some of his origins. And he tells a wonderful story in that he grew up in southern Chile in a kind of a little town in the mountains. Behind his house there was an old board fence with a hole in it, and he used to like to go look through that hole and see the fields beyond. And one day he says he was in the yard and he sensed something was about to happen. And another child, some little boy, stuck his hand through that hole in the fence and gave him a toy sheep. Neruda says it was the most wonderful toy he'd ever seen. It had these little wheels on it and covered with sheepskin. He says, I went inside and I got what at that time was my most precious possession, which was a pine cone. And he came out and he stuck the pine cone through the hole and gave it back to this other kid. Now, Neruda has commented on this story many, many times. The first thing he says is that's an anonymous gift. He never knew who gave him this thing. And he said that's a wonderful thing in life, to know that there are people who we don't know who are somehow looking out for us and watching over us and thinking about us. And an anonymous gift, of course, puts you in an odd position. To whom do you express your gratitude if you don't know who gave you the gift?
To the wide world.
Yes. And so Neruda says, I have tried in my life to give in exchange for human brotherhood, for the fact of being part of humanity. I've tried to give something earthy in resonance. And he's thinking of the pine cone there. He associates his own poetry as like pine cones. Each poem is like one pine cone. Mm-hmm. Something resinous, I've tried to give something resinous in return for human brotherhood.
And resonant.
Yes. And he says, this gift, this mysterious gift, settled deep inside me like a sedimentary deposit, giving light to my poetry. So there's a sense of somehow his work is a return gift for that endowment we all have, both to be brought to life, to be given our own culture that other people made, to be given the language, and to be given the works of other artists from the past. You know, in the 20th century, we don't really know what language to use to speak about these things which come to us out of the darkness,
unbidden.
In a way.
Mm-hmm.
I think of gifts at that level as mysteries. And I use the word, the old etymology of mystery has to do, the word comes from a Greek word that means to close your mouth, to not be able to say something. And one sense of that is that in the Greek world, the mysteries were things that nobody was supposed to talk about. They were secrets. But another sense of it may be that there are things we can't talk about. There are things where language fails us. And so where our gift comes from and what obligations of reciprocity it brings with it, what we have to do and what we shouldn't do to preserve the spirit of the gift, these things are mysterious. And we struggle all the time to find a way to talk about them. To say they come from God, that may be the best way to talk about them. To say that they come, that there's some sort of species essence, that we have millions of years of developing this thing called a human being, and that there's an endowment that comes mysteriously out of the past, and we don't know how to describe it. That may be, in a way, that's the modern way to talk about an evolutionary endowment. But in the end, I think they're mysterious.
Lewis Hyde teaches at Harvard University. Lewis Hyde is the author of The Gift, Imagination, and the Erotic Life of Property, published in 1983 by Random House. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Gifts and Friendship continues now. Here is commentary by Ronald Sharp, a professor of English at Kenyon College.
The classical ideal of selfless friendship has always been a sitting duck for satire. In our time especially, when we are so deeply attuned to lapses into sentimentality, it may seem naive to turn to gift exchange as an appropriate metaphor for friendship. There are, to be sure, other ways of conceiving friendship as a form of exchange. Montesquieu, for example, said that friendship is a compact by which we undertake to do someone small favors in expectation of receiving big favors. And La Rochefoucauld said that what men call friendship is really only a reciprocal servicing of interests, an exchange of good offices. It is finally only a commerce in which self-love proposes to itself something to be gained. In Lewis Hyde's terms, Rochefoucauld is saying that friendship is really just commodity exchange masquerading as gift exchange. It is not so much what we gain from our friends, says Cicero, as the very love of the friend itself that gives us joy. And what we get from a friend gives us joy since it comes to us with love. In other words, the major source of our joy in friendship lies not in what we receive from our friend, but in what we give to him, our love. As with the other advantages of friendship, we do also receive the gifts of our friend. But just as these must not be the motive for establishing the friendship, neither must they be seen as the most important source of joy. When you give a gift, says Lewis Hyde, it is as if you give a part of your substance to your gift partner and then wait in silence until he gives you a part of his. You put yourself in his hands. The movement, I think, is similar in friendship. And in both instances, the giver makes himself vulnerable. After all, what if there is no return? Many a friend has waited until the silence grows loud with denial or rejection. In friendship, as in gift exchange generally, there must always be an underlying principle of equilibrium. If one friend always does favors for another and there is no reciprocation, if one friend continually brings his troubles to the other but never vice versa, if one friend is always inviting but never invited, in all of these situations, the friendship obviously will be hard-pressed to survive without resentment. On the other hand, if I keep track of how many favors I've done for you and how many you've done for me, if I'm aware that I've listened to your problems 3 times more this year than you've listened to mine, this counting too will poison the friendship. The concern with balance cannot intrude itself into the foreground of the friendship without spoiling it. Yet without balance, it becomes impossible to preserve the trust that is required for a sustained relationship of giving. This delicate balance is always difficult to maintain, but when one friend feels betrayed in a friendship, it collapses altogether. For in these terms, betrayal is not equivalent to not giving or returning a gift, nor even to not graciously or appreciatively accepting one. It is rather like accepting a gift and responding by heaping abuse on the one who gave it. Sometimes, simple lack of reciprocity will be experienced as betrayal. But when you believe that your friend has actively violated the friendship, it is not uncommon to suddenly know precisely what the score is. In these circumstances, you often know not only the score, 6 invitations to 3, but you announce it, if not to the betrayer, at least to yourself or to others. After all I've done for him, after all those favors. When the gift compact is violated, its magic falls away, throwing our vulnerability into dramatic relief, and thus making us all too ready to revert to the safer mode of commodity exchange. One way of defining the best friendships may be to say that they are those in which the issues I have just raised never become problems. That, in any case, strikes me as an ideal worth admiring.
Ronald Sharp teaches at Kenyon College. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a forthcoming study of the English poet John Keats and the romantic idea of friendship. Ronald Sharp's most recent book is Friendship and Literature, published in 1986 by Duke University Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Gifts and Friendship, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the topic will be Teachers on Teaching. My guests will include scholars and high school teachers who participated in a recent summer institute on secondary education sponsored by the National Humanities Center. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Gifts and Friendship, the topics this week on Soundings. Listen for the authors of 2 recent books about gift exchange and friendship. Lewis Hyde of Harvard University and Ronald Sharp of Kenyon College provide some answers and insights. Gift exchange and friendship. Listen this week for Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.